Hi everyone, welcome back. Podchat Live episode 111, 111. Recording this on the 30th of January 2024. How are you, Craig? Is everything well?
No, I'm good. Good. Calfmuscle's good. About to up it to 5K tomorrow. So I tend to break down at 6K. So I'm going nice and slow and steady.
We're coming towards the threshold to the ceiling. We wish you well. I think I told you I was in Belgium last week doing some teaching with Spooner, Dr. Simon Spooner. And as you know, a couple of days spent with him are always they're always fun filled. And let me just give a shout out to the company that looked after us, Voetform. Hope I've said that correctly. Incredible hospitality, great company. If you're in Belgium, please do check them out for your podiatric CPD. The great bunch of delegates. Belgian podiatrists are crazy smart. They are really, really on the ball. We had a great group. We had some lovely comments actually in the break. Had a few people come up to me about the podcast saying they love the new format, which is very cool. That's always nice. And a bit of a shout out to Thomas DeWolf, who took me on a little run, a little tour of Ghent around the canals as well. Absolutely legend. Other thing to say, actually, I meant to say to you, Craig, is I have a friend who is based in Kenya. His name is George Parks, and I know him because I helped him sort of set up a running shoe shop in Kenya, and we went through sort of how to onboard some of his kind of running shoe staff, and we kind of talked through it a few years back. And he was in England, in London, just this week for his mum's birthday, so we caught up for a coffee, and he said to me he's actually a subscriber to your online running shoe. You know, your Podiatry CPD Academy running shoe course. And he said, when he said, "Oh, I miss Podchat Live," and I said to him, "Well, actually, we're back. We've been back for about 10 episodes now." He wasn't aware. So, not only have we got now listeners in Belgium, we got listeners in Kenya now as well. And he said to me, "Oh, great. I'll tune back in. If you're speaking to Craig this week, can you ask him if there's any kind of update or any kind of, is there going to be any more movement on the running shoe Academy CPD, just given what's happened in recent years?"
Oh, look, no, yes and no. I with the courses I had there, the plan was to update things as often as need be, and to take down a video and update it. It's actually a lot of work, so that's when I started doing the weekly updates. So just there's snippets in there, and I was covering everything. So yeah, look, I haven't done an weekly update for a while because there's nothing of significance to change the core content of the course. But yes, no, of course there will be updates and more coming.
He'll be delighted. He'll be delighted.
Time's a huge factor, and obviously some of the stuff, the updates, some of the stuff there we're covering in the Podchat Live.
Well, I did say as such to him. I said, get all of your staff just onto the weekly podcast, and they'll not only have shoe facts, but any papers that come up, we will. This is a much nicer medium, I think, to discuss things as they break, isn't it? On which note, shoe fact this week comes courtesy of our friends at P3 Podiatry, Talisha in particular. Thank you. She's a legend. And she pinged something through to us that was of interest. And it was about shoe mass, which is always a fascinating topic. Go ahead.
Well, the assumption's always been the lighter the shoe, the better, the faster you can run. And obviously, having a dead weight on your feet is going to slow you down. So the latest Li-Ning racing shoe is down to an incredible 85 grams. Obviously, Li-Ning are the key running shoe manufacturer in China. They do produce some pretty awesome shoes, and I have seen quite a bit of research published by their biomechanics group and people that do that. So, but they look. Obviously, I haven't seen the shoe, but the 85 grams looks to be because of the they've just cut out the heel area. The assumption is you're going to be running fast, you're going to be on the forefoot. By comparison, the key Adidas say racing shoes, the Pro Evo 1 is 138 grams versus the Li-Ning's 85. Now, when you sent this through to me, that it reminded me of a blog post that I wrote back in 2013. Now, back in the late 70s, early 80s, I was running pretty close to 100 miles a week in a variety of different running shoes. But one of the shoes I really enjoyed back then was the Arthur Lydiard inspired EB Bruting Roadrunner from Germany. It was a very popular shoe back then. In 2018, the shoe was actually remade as a sort of nostalgic shoe, and I could not wait to get my hands on it. I was glad I got it. It weighs 485 grams. You know, the Li-Ning racing shoe is 85. I could not run in these shoes. Despite running 100 miles a week in them many, many years ago, I managed down the road and I had to come back and change my shoes and go out for my run. You know, they were rigid. They had a 10 mil drop. They were very stiff. And that was the norm back then. Look where we've come now.
That is like running with ankle weights on. That is incredible. Funny you mentioned the Adidas shoe there. At 138, that is that's an incredibly light shoe, but it sounds like a bit of a juggernaut compared to 85, doesn't it? So I always wonder about there being a sweet spot, not just metabolically. You know, we know that generally speaking, lighter means there can be metabolic efficiency benefits, but from a point of view of all the things that we take from a shoe, not just its metabolic efficiency, but things like its comfort and its ride, there must be, if a shoe can be too heavy and clumpy, at the other end it can definitely be too light, and you could feel perhaps like it's compromising its durability or its protection it gives you, or whatever values you place on a shoe. So I think, and again, the beauty is that sweet spot will be slightly different for everyone. 85 makes me nervous. I like more material around my feet than that.
Oh, it could well be the Ning shoe's a one race shoe and you discard it. You know, like it's, you know, it's that's
Yeah, that's not an
but,
uncommon marketing thing now, is it?
yeah. But also, I mean, the difference between 85 versus 138 for the Adidas, how noticeable is that when it's on your feet weight wise? You're talking very small amounts, and yeah, it's.
I'm pretty certain in England in the winter you pick up more than 40 or 50 grams of mud on any given long run on a
Oh,
Sunday. So
yep.
let us go. Anyway, thanks Tanisha for that. Lovely stuff. I think I gave P3 Podiatry a shout out a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to do it again. They got great social media. They're always producing great content. They've just recently done a podcast on the Foot Posture Index, which is super interesting as well. And I encourage people to go listen to them. Right, let's move on to some of the things that we've seen in print in this last week. And this one is particularly intriguing. A lot of papers, a lot of things we see that have been published are interesting because they have perhaps clinical application or they're topics of interest to us. This, you could argue, doesn't have either of those, but it is something that we should be aware of and something that we should be mindful of. And that is that, and it was published in Nature, and the summary is essentially that in the year 2023, so last year, more than 10,000 research papers were retracted. Now, I'm sure many of you know that what, but just to be absolutely clear and explicit for people that may not, a retraction is when a paper is published and then the editor-in-chief of that journal pulls it after the fact for numerous reasons. 10,000 in 2023 is a new record. So this has been trending on the way up, but just to give you an idea of what a jump this is, in 2018, there were 2,000 papers retracted. In 2019 and 2020, it increased to around 3,000. And in 2021 and 2022, it was around 4,000. So it was clearly on the way up, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 over kind of a 6-year period. But we've jumped from 4,000 in 2022 to 10,000 last year. Integrity experts, I don't know. I don't know what that means, by the way. I don't know how you become that, but integrity experts say this is only the tip of the iceberg as well. And certain countries are a little bit more sort of guilty of this, notably Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Russia, and China. So perhaps if we're reading articles out of countries such as that, that should be on our minds as well. Craig, you always across this. You were one of the first people many, many years ago to even make me aware of Retraction Watch, the website that I know you regularly frequent. Do you have any thoughts, any hot takes on what's going on here? And what I mean by that is, not just why papers are being retracted, but why we've got such a sharp, sudden spike in the last 12 months.
A couple of comments. The first one is that of those 10,000, 8,000 were actually from one publisher, which is a little bit nervous. And that's Hindawi, which are a subsidiary of Wiley. Now, they are a borderline predatory publisher, but they're trying to be more mainstream. Now, most of the retractions are due to things like the peer review process has been compromised. Like people nominated certain people who could do the peer review who didn't exist, and might have been them doing their peer review, or there might be peer review circles where people agree to peer review each other's papers and give them a free pass. The other key issue for retractions is to do with authorship. And I'll certainly link to this. There was one retraction last week on a quite an interesting paper on an interosseous lipoma of the calcaneus mimicking plantar fasciitis. And I remember reading that when it came out, thought, oh, that's interesting, file that away. But it's been retracted now because two of the authors didn't even know they were authors of the paper, and none of the other authors could have their identity verified. So obviously the publisher was concerned when these two alleged authors said, we don't know anything about this paper, tried to find the other authors, and they didn't exist. And that's quite common in those countries that you named, that sort of, to give more multi-authorship to papers. There was also, so, and then I also sort of track a lot of the foot-related retractions. There's been some on hallux rigidus, there's been some surgical ones retracted. No major ones. It's just that that particular one caught my eye because I thought the paper was quite interesting. The other reason for retractions is faking of data. And they are the more serious ones. They are not as common as the other reasons. The most notable one there, and what I think is behind this big spike, is COVID-related research. There have been a lot of papers exposed as having fraudulent data relating to COVID-related studies. Probably the biggest one was an early study on ivermectin, which was touted as the cure-all for COVID, and the cookers and the cranks got onto it and still swear by it being the treatment for COVID symptoms. This particular study clearly showed it was extraordinarily effective, but it turned out that every, well, it turned out that what appears to be every patient in the study didn't exist. Some of the people included in the study actually died before the study started. So clearly it was retracted, and it got a lot of publicity. So there are a lot of other COVID-related studies that I suspect make up that 10,000 people trying to make a name for themselves during the pandemic. Even on hydroxychloroquine, again, that's something that Donald Trump touted as the magic bullet. The number of retractions around that's really, really quite extraordinary. So again, it's something everyone needs to be aware of. And I know talking to colleagues, I've never heard of it. That happens. And again, you mentioned the blog called Retraction Watch, and they comment and link to papers. They even mentioned my name in one of their blog posts for flagging a paper that was retracted, a barefoot running paper that got retracted. But that was over the failure of the author to declare his commercial links.
I think it might be useful for us to link to Retraction Watch in the show notes, because people will hopefully, in the same way that we should probably be regularly scanning journals and looking for papers that are published, it's not bad practice to look for papers that have been retracted as well. It's a good point about COVID, and then what we're possibly seeing now is sort of a delay. As we know, when people actually do research, you often don't see it in print for a couple of years, so a delay for that. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Great stuff.
Can I just make one more comment? There was a series of papers on hydroxychloroquine by a French researcher that supported hydroxychloroquine's use in COVID. And they all got retracted over ethical reasons. That particular author has now created his own journal online and published them all again.
Yeah, that is
You know.
the academic version of not being allowed to play, taking your own ball away when you don't like the way the game's being played. So Yep. Okay. Right. Let's get back onto a paper that's sort of relevant to us. And again, we're big fans of talking about papers that have been recently published. And we've got another one here for you, which was published 29th of January, 2024. So I make that yesterday. This is by Mansur and colleagues who are based out of Brazil. It was published in Orthopedic Surgery and it is entitled Leg Length Discrepancy is Not a Risk Factor for plantar fasciitis. So they took 120 people, put them in two groups. There was a group of them that had plantar fasciitis, as they referred to, and a group of them that were asymptomatic and pain-free. And then they looked at the differences in leg length difference between the groups. Now, interestingly, there's a few points for discussion in a second here, but they defined a leg length discrepancy because I always like to say, okay, at what point would they kind of suggest that one was present? Their definition was a difference greater than 0.64 centimeters in the scanometry determined the criteria for the presence of a leg length difference. And then they concluded that they did not observe differences in the mean discrepancy or in the prevalence of leg length discrepancy between the groups. So, two immediate thoughts to me. The first is that they've taken people with plantar fasciitis and they've looked at whether there's a leg length. So that's a correlation study or a cross-sectional study. And you look at the title and it's talking about leg length discrepancy as a risk factor. So I feel like that title's misleading. You can't ascertain risk from this methodology. But secondly, 0.64 centimeters. I tend to work in millimeters personally when I talk about leg length. So that's 6.5 millimeters. Or sorry, 6.4 millimeters, I should say. It's an incredibly specific number, and I don't know how or why they've got it, because my understanding of the literature, when we talk about the debate about when a leg length discrepancy becomes significant, is a bit higher than that. Almost every literature I've seen is very much in double figures, some saying as high as 20 millimeters. So let me ask you, Craig, what are we thinking about 6.4 mil as the cutoff point for a leg length discrepancy? How or why have they got there?
I have no idea. If I was to do this study, one of the questions you'd have to ask is what is to be our cutoff point. So what I would do, and again, I'm not saying this is what they did. You'd then this work has either been done, so you'd use that data, and I don't know if it has been done or not. But you'd take a large group of people and you'd measure the leg length difference. What's the mean difference in leg length differences? And then perhaps one standard deviation from the mean is 0.64. So we'll define a leg length difference as being one standard deviation from what the mean difference is. Now, I have no idea if they did that, but it is possible they might have done something like that to come up with such a precise figure of 0.64. So again, I'm
Yeah.
speculating and guessing,
No,
but
I think that's a good point because 0.64 is specific enough that it suggests to me they didn't just pluck it out the air. That would have been a 0.65. 0.64 suggests some kind of maths was done to get there in my head.
Sure. But also 0.64, I think, is within the margin of error clinically. They obviously used a scanometry, so it's a lot more accurate. But clinically, I think we're plus or minus that anyway.
Well, it immediately comes to mind when you look at a paper and you look at its methodology. One of the things you ask yourself is, does this reflect clinical practice? And I ask the listeners how many of them would see a six mil leg length difference and consider it significant. I guess that's another way to ask the question. That said, by the way, the fact that they conclude that, they don't think leg length discrepancy is a risk factor for plantar fasciitis, that very much speaks to my bias. I'm sort of on board with that as a conclusion. I just don't think this paper, this methodology can firmly state that. But actually, it's kind of in keeping with what my beliefs already are. I don't know about you, but I certainly wouldn't, I wouldn't expect leg length difference to be up on my high list of risk factors for plantar heel pain anyway.
No, well, I like you, I mean, we just finished talking about retracted papers and peer review. The title of this paper slipped through the peer review. That should not have been the title. It's not a risk factor. It's a correlation between those with plantar fasciitis having a leg length difference or not. It could well be, and this is I'm not for 1 minute suggesting this, but it could well be that, well, yes, a leg length difference is a risk factor, but then they get plantar fasciitis, and because of the plantar fasciitis, they start limping, and because of that, changes in the pelvis mean the leg lengths are the same. So I doubt that's the case, but that's the problem with these cross-sectional studies. They can come up with some interesting data, but you can come up with several plausible explanations and some implausible explanations as to why they found it.
Yeah, such is the fun of research. And I guess that's what we have always wanted to achieve on this new sort of delivery of the podcast. And that's get papers that have been recently published, signposted for people so that they can go and find them themselves. But our message has very much been, don't just read the abstract and believe it. Kind of get into the weeds, look at the methodology, look at the clinical application, critique it, appraise it. And, that's kind of what we do, and that's kind of what we know that a lot of people already do as well. Just looked at my timer and realized we've hit our time. So I'm going to close up, and I'm going to close up with my
Actually,
usual.
can I just make one more comment on what you just said then about a properly appraising research? One thing I really hate coming across is when the critical appraisal and the depth that people go to try and debunk something that doesn't fit their narrative, and the free passes they give to the studies that fit their narrative. You apply the same standard to everything.
No, good call. You're quite right. Sometimes it's not nice when you see, if you see a paper that contradicts your beliefs, you go looking. You go, perhaps you would spend twice as long critiquing it as you would a paper that speaks to your beliefs. So yeah, no, you're quite right. So let me wrap up with my usual messaging of thanking everyone for listening, thanking everyone for sharing the podcast, asking for that continuation of that, looking at our ratings on our. On the two main, I guess, podcast mediums that people listen on. We are now up to 42 ratings on Spotify. So thank you very much. We are nearly at the magic 50 that I was hoping for. And we've crept up to 20 on Apple. And we've had a couple more reviews on Apple as well. The stats that we don't often look at because we don't care about stats, but out of interest, we looked at them last week. And it turns out 60% of our listeners are listening on Apple. Which really surprised me. I just assumed because that everyone was on Spotify. So come on, Apple listeners, get the game, up your game. We want 50 reviews and ratings on Apple. And as soon as we do, I will shut up and I won't say it anymore on each episode. So thank you in advance. Follow us on social media, Podchat Live, X/Twitter or Instagram, or email us. Get involved at podchatlive.com. As always, email us with your thoughts on something we've said, anything you would like us to talk about, or just if you want to signpost or flag something to us. Anything else you want to say before we depart, Craig?
No, that's all. It's all good. So thanks to everyone for listening, and hopefully they will comment some more on Apple.
Lovely stuff. See you next week.
Okay, see ya.